tried those god-awful blueberry. You might have liked them, but those blueberry gluten-free muffins.
Oh, yeah. It tastes like cardboard.
I mean, they were delicious to me. You didn't like are you kidding me? But again, that's always a test for me, right? When it comes to gluten-free foods, I have to have my son test it because I'll think it's amazing. I'll be like, yo, Darian, you gotta try this gluten-free something goody. And he'll try it and he'll be like, oh, thanks, Dad. Those are all you. Those are all you.
I'll pass on that one. Right. Thanks.
Welcome back to the Good Food Podcast, a podcast where we discuss food sovereignty, food access, our relationship with the environment, and our relationship with each other. How all of these come together to feed this discussion of the Good Food District. I'm your host, Anthony Avalos. Joining me this evening will be Miss Diane Moss and Miss Sona Desai. Now, Sona has been part of the movement to build a more sustainable and equitable food system for over 25 years. She has a diverse background in organic farming, food and farm business development, food marketing and retail, and is recognized nationally as a leader in food hub and community food systems development. She is currently a co-executive director at the San Diego Food System Alliance and leads the Local Food Economy Lab. Sona is actively engaged in the local food and farm community in San Diego, and she currently serves on the board of directors for Food Shed Cooperative and Project New Village. She is deeply committed to supporting small-scale farmers, especially Black and Brown farmers, and co-creating a world that uplifts self-determination, democracy, and love. Sona, it's such a pleasure for you to be joining us today. Can you please tell us a bit more about yourself?
Thanks, Anthony. It's an honor to be here with you and Diane. I am, as you mentioned, have the privilege of being the chair of Project New Village Board of Directors, and also a co-executive director of the San Diego Food System Alliance. And I've been in that role for about 6 years now.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with me today, or sharing your time with us today. So to open things up, I would like for you, Ms. Moss, first, and then you second, Sona. Can you briefly share your journey in the fight for food justice and equity? Basically, what sparked your interest and passion for food systems work?
So I've been a community organizer and activist for social justice like forever, like my entire adult life. But in 2008, I met Ellie Eigel. We were sitting at a table together. We had all day at a conference for nonprofits. I met her and she impressed upon me that food justice was an issue. Wasn't on my radar. I figure you got food the way you got food. It wasn't up there with other social justice issues. However, after 8 days in the same place, I went to a subsequent meeting in City Heights, saw some people come down from Sacramento. They made a presentation on the problem with food insecurity. I looked around the room. I didn't see nobody from our neighborhood. I looked around the room. I didn't see many people I knew. The information was compelling. So I came back to the community and started saying, what's our relationship with food in this area? I got some answers immediately, and that's how Project New Village got started, if you will, looking at food justice or food injustice or food insecurity. 2008, Ellie Eigel.
We are so appreciated. Are so appreciative that you did. Sona, to you.
Yeah, you know, like you, Diane, I also had sort of that activism early on, you know, was really part of some movements, human rights movements, around supporting Leonard Peltier and Mumia Abu-Jamal when I was in college. And that sort of extended to second half of my college years, where I discovered gardening and was part of this movement to develop a garden on campus at the university that I was at. And that changed my world. ironically, around that same time was when the federal government was looking to develop national organic standards. And so this was back in the mid-90s, and it was one of the largest movements of public comment and input on the standards for organic in the country, because it was the first time that they were going to actually have the federal government regulate organic farming. And at that time, they wanted to include sewage sludge, irradiated products, and genetically modified organisms as allowable under organic. So it was the largest uprising of people coming out to comment and basically say, no way, we don't want that in our food. That is not organic to me. So I was really fortunate at that moment to be part of this movement and, you know, did public comment. And that was probably one of my first, you know, moments of actually doing public testimony or comments for some kind of U.S. federal policy. And from then on, it just changed my world. I was part of a movement to want to grow better food and try to figure out how we get food to those that haven't historically had access to it. And I started farming. I experienced firsthand what it's like to be a brown girl in my early 20s, trying to develop a farm and access resources for that. I spent about 10 years trying to build that farm and that vision, and ultimately ended up where I am now, which is not farming, but in a support role where I'm committed, continue to be committed to supporting people and communities that historically haven't had agency to be able to figure out how they can bring that into their lives and their communities. So that's my story.
I told you, y'all. I told you. So I think what's awesome about this is that both of you ladies used language that identifies some of the challenges that our food system experiences, especially if you come from the communities that we come from and you look like we look. That brings us to the conversation of food apartheid. Now, that's a term that highlights the systemic nature of inequitable food access. Ms. Moss, can you explain how this differs from the more commonly used term foods desert and why that matters?
Yeah, well, good things happen in deserts. It doesn't have to be all bad. So for you to say this is a desert, what we're trying to say, whereas food apartheid really means it was an intentional on somebody's part. Apartheid just doesn't happen because it's part of nature. It's because some human being did something. And other people, and it impacts other folks. So the apartheid here is that we don't have the food that we need on this side of town, and we're not the people who made that decision.
Sona, from your experience, what are the key policies or systems that perpetuate food apartheid in our communities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the most tangible ones is you look at a community and you say, you have no grocery stores. So we're going to come in here and we're going to build a large supermarket chain. We're going to bring in some grocery store, some development that we think is going to meet community needs. So what that ignores is, one, all of the markets that might already exist in a community, all of the, I don't love the word assets, but, you know, all of the resources, all of the talents, all of the gifts, all of the wisdom that already exists in communities and what they're doing and what their ideas are for their communities. And instead it replaces that with some larger corporate, usually force that, or outside influence that says, this is what we think you need. This is what we're going to bring into your community. And that's apartheid. At the end of the day, it's stripping a community, a people, of agency.
And so how does food apartheid as a concept, right, that people are now going to be experiencing possibly for the first time, how does that specifically impact our communities? What historical context do we need to understand how to tackle it effectively?
You said first time. What do you mean by that? Because we've never had what we needed here, ever, even when it was handing out cheese.
So when I say hearing food apartheid for the first time,
hearing the term.
That's correct.
Okay.
Absolutely. This may be a new concept because some people may mistakenly believe that this was all by accident. It was happenstance. It, just like a desert is created by nature, that somehow our access to what we have access to was naturally occurring.
So I'm going to reflect. When I first brought this concept up to Tom Buzzi, because of the importance of apartheid, he didn't get into it. He thought it was apartheid was too strong a term to use for an issue related to food. It didn't have the political need or the political meaning that apartheid meant to put it to food, because you had other options with food. Problem with that is you don't always know what the other options are. We go for convenience. We go what fits into the way things are done to challenge existing systems. That's a resistance move, and we have to. I want to say organize to that, right? Versus, I'm caught up here on the term, right? Because I don't care what you call it. It's wrong, and wrong is wrong, and we have to do righteous work in order to eradicate that. So there are those that will be stuck calling it the food desert, because that's what the government calls it, and we're used to doing what the government says, and we get that, right? But your actions have to speak differently if we really want change, change that can stay in the community. So,
and one of the ways that we feel, at least me personally, that change can happen is by the intentionality that we take, even in the language that we use. So I think that it is very important that people understand the difference between food apartheid and a food desert. And I think that one of the ways that we can do that is by discussing the idea of food sovereignty. It is more than access. It's about control. It's about empowerment. So how would you, Ms. Moss, define food sovereignty at Project New Village?
Food sovereignty means that you don't wait for other people to come in and solve the problem, that you actually have to be involved in addressing the problem yourself. So,
and then, Sona, why is food sovereignty crucial to achieving justice and equity, particularly in historically marginalized communities?
Well, Diane shared it, right? These are communities that haven't had that power to be able to design what it is that they need for them, right? So nothing for us without us. And so food sovereignty is really essential to achieving any goal of justice. Because at the end of the day, if you have a select few that have resources and have the power to be able to design what it is that they need and access what they need, and then you have others that don't, I don't see how you could possibly create a more just world or just society with that type of inequality. So food sovereignty is essential to achieving this mission.
So I absolutely agree. Back to what you were saying, as far as how the government sometimes uses the language that they see fit, can you, or how can local government better support community-led food sovereignty efforts?
So I'm not going to waste a lot of time trying to get the community, government to call something different. I don't care what you call it, but we, the community, I guess you say, have to take agency and say what we need to be done for this problem. Whether you call it a desert or we call it apartheid, there's a problem, and the problem's related to our health status. So there's no denying that. So what we do is rally my energy around activism for the solution. I mean, bringing in solutions. So we're going to talk about this good food district here. We're going to talk about the things that we're doing in terms of growing food, distributing food, and take actionable steps to get to a point where we have food sovereignty. Whether you have embraced the term or not, what we are doing is saying that we're sick, we don't have what we need, and we're taking steps to make that go away permanently.
And so as we transition into this conversation, the final question I want to ask you, Sona, on this is, what role do cultural practices and traditions play in food sovereignty?
Mm-hmm. Such a good question, and one that most people don't ask. So just even naming that, saying that out loud is hugely important. It has everything to do with food sovereignty, everything. I mean, at the end of the day, when we talk about food sovereignty and we talk about people being able to have self-determination, being able to be the ones that get to decide the policies and the resources and the communities that they need, that varies. There isn't one formula. There's not one formula, food sovereignty. Food sovereignty is about the how and the what you allow. It's about what we give to one another and grant to one another. It's not about an outcome that is the same everywhere. So food sovereignty in Southeastern San Diego is going to look very different from food sovereignty in and across tribal communities throughout San Diego County. For example, it's going to look very different even in communities bordering neighborhoods and communities. Food sovereignty looks different. However, at the end of the day, the way that we get to food sovereignty still requires the same types of actions, and that is power and agency for those communities to decide what it is that they need for them. And you asked Anthony earlier, what else can government do, or what do the people need to do in order to ensure that communities are able to have sovereignty? So in addition to resources, and this is going to tie into the Good Food District as well, but in addition to resources, ownership of land and capital. Those two pieces are essential. Resources alone, that's where we are now, right? People think you need resources and so you need a supermarket. And they're not thinking about the community ownership of land and capital that are also needed. So those, just wanting to name those two things.
And so, as we've mentioned it a couple times, there is the emergence of this idea called the Good Food District. And Project New Village describes their efforts to drive change through collaboration and collective action to create a good food district in order to dismantle the structural inequities facing Southeastern San Diego. And so, for both of you, what is the vision and the mission of the Good Food District, and how does it address food sovereignty and food apartheid?
So the mission is for us to change radically the neighborhood-based food system. So foods come in from somewhere. We can change that. We have backyards. We have empty space. We have public space, private space. The space could be used differently. So we serve as a catalyst to make that happen. Just this year, we established 25 growing spaces, independent of any government. These are people who own their property and allow us to have a relationship where they grow food. We have partnerships where we're growing community gardens. And the end game for this growing things that we're doing is to distribute it for our mobile farmers market. And about a year from now, or 2 years from now, we'll be doing that distribution at a higher level because we're building our own grocery store, right? So we look at the aspects that are key for us to have, to grow the food, to distribute the food. Somehow environmentally, this is done in the planet, the context of this planet. So we look at composting and how we take care of the planet at the same time we take care of ourselves with the food that we produce here. And the end game is that we'll have healthier, more just communities and routes to access good food in our neighborhoods. I don't have to get in the car and go nowhere. I can go walk in walking distance. People can go and access food. So for me, the Good Food District is a placemaking effort, a regenerative placemaking effort. Our intention is to use urban agriculture and community organizing as tools to revitalize our community here in Southeastern San Diego.
And placemaking is really, it's the term, that term, yeah, which is really appropriate here, because something that we don't always connect is the intersection between food, health, and place. So when we talk about the Good Food District, placemaking captures that.
This gives me an opportunity to talk about how we got to this Good Food District piece. You know, we have a Good Food District team that's been meeting since the inception of this project. And on that team are these intersectional professionals, one of which I'm just going to highlight. And at some point, she's going to be on our podcast. She's in Belgium right now, so she couldn't be here. But Pascal is a professor at San Diego State, and I think she's one of the co-chairs of the geography department. It is she who got us looking at placemaking and the geography and using maps. So you take our social advocacy skills and you define a space. How we were able to look at southeastern San Diego, but put it in a good food district with the neighboring communities in Lemon Grove, National City, and recently to the west of us in Barrio Logan, is because we share experiences around food. If a grocery store closes, or the 99-cent store closed in Lemon Grove, so a lot of folks in 92114, that's my neighborhood, that's where people go because there was where you could get California-grown organic food. That's what it said. So it closed down. That impacted people not only in Lemon Grove, but in southeastern San Diego. Same thing happened in National City when they closed Wrigley's Market. It's right there on the border, so it impacted us. It impacted them. Because we have these shared experiences, this then became the basis for having a geographically-based effort that we then call the Good Food District. Good food, we've been using that term because good food is more than how it tastes. There's a variety of definitions that go into good food. And then somebody in the room said, well, it's got to be a district. It's got to be an area. And it came up as a result of our meeting and good minds being in a room and coming up with that term. We now see it other places and we can say that we coined that term. And it's good that other people use it because it means something. But we started it right here in the work that we're doing in southeastern San Diego.
And, you know, the Good Food District is also a strategy that we didn't talk about San Diego County Food Vision 2030, which Diane, you were a big part of, you know, over 3,000 San Diegans that were a part of creating San Diego County Food Vision 2030. And what that really is a vision, a dream of what we all have collectively for food system in San Diego County. And one of the primary objectives of that is community food environments, improving community food environments. And a key strategy for that is promoting food sovereignty. So when we talk about the Good Food District, when we talk about the work of Project New Village here in southeastern San Diego, this is intimately connected to this broader vision that not just we here have for this community, but it's a collective vision that over 3,000 San Diegans have shared is important for them. And as we think about building this village, it isn't just for this community. It is a pathway for being able to imagine how we develop this in other communities. So it's a model. It's a model. And it's a model that creates an alternative to the traditional way that food justice or food efforts have been approached in other communities.
The Village. Talk to us just for a moment about what the Village represents for our community.
So, you know, this Good Food District that we've been talking about, at the center of it is this development, right? The Village. And what the Village represents to us, it'll be the first time, my knowledge, and I've been living in this community since the 80s, that we, the people, are building a permanent asset to meet our needs. Sona had said it earlier in terms of self-determination. So this village, look at this. This is a two-story, multi-use kind of building where this would be. There would continue to be, and I should say it's on Market Street, where we currently have the Mount Hope Community Garden. I think through our stories, you know that we bought that property, and now we're building and maximizing the use of that property for this community. And our dream, our being the people who put in the time, that's the residents and cross-sectional team of professionals, have come up with a design where we're maintaining part of the garden space because we always want to grow, right? Then we have a two-story building where we have our own grocery store. We have several eateries, and the emphasis on these eateries are healthier food, locally sourced, reasonably priced food. We'll have opportunities where there's meeting space, indoor, outdoor meeting space. There's a commercial kitchen for those who cook, prepare food. There's a teaching unit here. There's a second level where we're deciding what will happen at that level, but some other kind of benefit or value-aligned activity on that second floor. And these are things that would be permanent assets in southeastern San Diego, determined by, used by the people who live here and others that know that this is a good source for good food. One thing that's really important, too, in terms of this community engagement, what I'm pumped and jazzed about right now, is we get to curate every item in the grocery store. So I've never had this experience, y'all. I've been on the planet at least like 6 decades plus. And I'm a shopper and the primary shopper in my family, right? But I've never gone to a store or had the experience or even known anybody that the store that it's in our neighborhood, every item in there, we chose it. Every item has a narrative. So if you messed up the environment, we don't have to sell your stuff. If you did something bad to somebody somewhere in terms of social justice, I ain't mentioning no names, but we don't have to sell your stuff. So we're looking at what things taste like, where they come from, what their social orientation is, what they've done for the environment. And then we, the people who live here, will pick what it is that we want in our store. Clearly, we're paying attention to taste and price. But we're also looking beyond that and say, who do we want to support and bring in our neighborhood? And we have the self-determining, the right, the way to do that. And it's a learning process because I don't know all the alternatives to the name brands that I find in these other stores. But who do we want to help and lift up in our neighborhood? And one of those would be home cooks, those Miko folks, people we know that have good things that they do in the community, giving them a place where they can go and spread their love and spread their food with us. Right here in the village.
So when we hear the phrase good food, it's not just a slogan, right? This is putting real work, real support, real community behind this phrase of good food district. One of the things that I loved about the conversations that we've had is this idea that we want Southeast San Diego San
Either
Diego,
one.
Depending on the generation you came up in. Listen, we're still talking about it. We want Southeastern San Diego to be a destination for people to be able to come here and discover, maybe for the first time, some of the delicious and healthy options that are being created in the Good Food District.
Yeah, just having the conversations about what we're going to do. So I live in Hamishaw, right? One of the neighborhoods in southeastern San Diego. So we had a neighborhood meeting a couple of weeks ago. I didn't know we had so many chefs and plant-based cooks right in my neighborhood. So they're talking about they don't have a place to lease. Everything costs too much. I'm thinking, I didn't want to come in and make a commercial for Project New Village, but this is our neighborhood. So I happened to have my tear sheet, and I was able to say, so there's 6 spaces here. And the guy says, how much does it cost? I says, you need to join us because we haven't determined that yet. And we want it to be useful to both of us. He got jazzed, man. He wrote down his email. This is my neighbor. I don't know him, but he's a baker. He comes here from New York, but he's been here a couple decades looking and hoping for an opportunity. So now you can plug in, not just as a tenant, but help us build something in the neighborhood where we live. I'm stoked about that, y'all.
And then, Sona, for you to answer, and this is kind of a different version of the same question, how does the Good Food District go beyond just providing food to actively engage and empower the community? I think you did speak to this a bit just a moment ago, but if you could just kind of double down on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know, Diane shared the mission, right, which is to clearly transform the food environment in southeastern San Diego. And the how, you know, is really, this isn't overnight. I mean, been working on this for, I don't know what, 20 plus years now. And so that work is about engaging and building community first in being able to have them be the ones that are able to identify what's needed here and to start building that. And then the second is what we're building. And so that's where the village comes in and this concept for the village.
And it leads me to this next question. Whomever wants to take this, What partnerships or policies do you think are critical for the district's long-term success?
The number one partnership is the residents that live here.
Yep.
Number one. And then we That's live right. in a space that has boxes. One of the boxes is the city council, a couple representatives here. So there's some things we need to do around advocacy to change policies. We talked about land earlier. The city budget, we do partnerings with other, I want to say, progressive groups that are advocating for how we spend money at the government level. If food is essential, then we need to put an investment in how we bring the food here. So these lots, I'm not going to talk a lot about that lot on 47th Street that's sitting there, right? That this government lot that we've been seeing it be raggedy for years and years. We here at the community sit ready to help them deal with that problem. We're here. We see it. They might be in offices somewhere where they don't, but making some things happen, and we can be accountable for what we do. Partners and other nonprofits. So progressive groups, people that get it, that food is essential. And in order for us to get it, then we have to do some things differently and work together. So government is key. Philanthropic community is key. But number one is the people who live here.
Yeah, and I agree with all that. And the thing I would add around what other partners can do, those that that need to help resource this, if you will. So those are, you know, this is where we talk about political and philanthropic investment, and that's money. It's money. It's resource. That's the number one resource that is needed for communities like Southeastern San Diego to be able to actualize their vision for a food sovereign community. So money is really what has been denied for centuries. And now it's what we need to be able to give so that we can repair and restore the power that lies within these communities.
Project New Village has some big things in store. And so in a future where some of those resources are provided, how does the Good Food District support food producers? What is your vision for how we will support farmers and entrepreneurs, especially those from within our communities?
So we currently have a network of growers. We meet on a monthly basis. We provide in-house services, if you will. We have a community of practice, so there's a standard. We eat in this food, so we have a standard for which it needs to be produced, and we're giving assistance. We have a couple of master gardeners on our staff that will go out and assist people. We have a wonderful partnership, and I'm going to just say this, with Treedom. They will go. You got some irrigation issues. You got some other kinds of technical issues. They are on the ready to help with any assistance people need moving forward with growing food. If there's access to water and the cost of things, we get right back into putting funds together so we can support people in the growing of food. So water is essential. What you do with your soil is essential. Even people packaging and getting things ready so they can move it somewhere. Some of the people who grow food for us don't have transportation. So making the logistical kind of hookup with people to get what they're growing to the marketplace. These are the kind of things that we are currently doing, and just staying ready to upgrade as the needs present themselves. We plan on going bigger, so I'm assuming that the needs might be bigger, and we'll have to grow our staff and capacity to deal with that. And that's a good problem to have.
Can you real briefly speak to the importance that you've described many times in your work, the importance of youth and community engagement as we continue through this process?
So we don't, these are the residents, right? These are the, I'll say foot soldiers. We don't have a food movement if we don't have these folks at the table. I just remember some of the first things when we opened up the Mount Hope Community Garden. So there are a lot of grown people around doing what we do, but then there were these Girl Scouts who were experiencing growing food or seeing food growing in the ground for the first time. And just to see their faces when they tasted strawberries, and it wasn't from some aisle in a grocery store, it was here where they found it. They washed it off and they ate it, and then they shared. And then, children do a lot of prancing. They do things. They get excited about this relationship with food. And to see that, then we have an opportunity, we grown folks who care, to get them involved in a better relationship with their food. Because I'm sick of these hot Cheetos and other things that you see for breakfast and stuff. So we have an opportunity to share a better way. And we're trying at this point to even make some benefits for people who choose a better way. You know, we recently got a grant from the Prevost Foundation so that we can take people on tours and have a better relationship with outside nature while enjoying food and urban agriculture. And you get to join these trips on a monthly basis because you've chosen to come and volunteer with our organization and do a work day or somehow experience this and want to be involved. So, yes, it's probably more laborious for us to have to actually grow food or go someplace outside of a grocery store to get it. But we're trying to also widen the benefits from choosing this lifestyle. I don't even go into climate change and those kinds of things. It's get out of being comfortable, right? And we have to do some other things or things will stay the same.
There's a level of discomfort that we need to familiarize ourselves with if change is something that we're serious about.
Seriously. Well said.
And speaking to the necessary change, addressing food justice, as I've learned since stepping into this space and working with the illustrious Ms. Moss, it often feels like an uphill battle. I've noticed that in a lot of the spaces I've worked in, wins aren't something that we often get to relish. What are some of the biggest challenges that you have either faced or are currently facing in this work? And I can expand on that if you'd like.
Well, one thing comes to mind immediately now. We tell you that we're trying to put together a grocery store, which is a part of a food hub. So in order to do that, there's some money to be raised. And it's way out of our comfort zone. We're grassroots organizers doing things with our neighborhood. But now we need to interface with the philanthropic community and the government that says this is a worthy cause. We need you to join us at this level so that our community could be better. People don't have to listen to you, right? So the hard thing is making that money appear when we need the money. And we can't do any magical trips. It's through building relationships and making a point and hoping that on the, I don't want to say the other side, but on the philanthropic side, people feel what we're doing and that it would be a benefit and they should be a part of this movement.
And so, Sona, I would like to ask you, how can community members, policymakers, the philanthropic community, and other stakeholders contribute to advancing this mission?
Yeah. Well, community members getting involved, you know, whatever that looks like, you know, showing up at events, showing up to the garden, showing up to speak up for what it is that they want, what they're looking for. Policymakers, funders, I mean, we've said it several times, but it's about resourcing this work, resourcing these communities. And that's usually money. And you know, we are talking often about big sums of money. You know, this project that we're building here in Mount Hope is a $12 million project. This is an equitable food-oriented development. It's a development. We need $12 million. Right now, we're at about $4 million. So we're a third of the way there. So what we need from philanthropic and public communities is some help in making that a reality so that we can actually realize or become a little closer to realizing the vision that the community has for Southeastern San Diego.
Ms. Moss, what gives you hope and keeps you grounded in this work?
So, you know, we've had this journey of what I call minor miracles. You never know when the miracles are going to come, and they're only minor because it's not the whole world, but it's our universe. So we have these periodically, right? And sometimes people get it, and sometimes we get surprises and these different kinds of awards. But I think the one thing that keeps me going is being here at the ground level and seeing the stories and seeing people when they make a transition, when they get it, right? When they get that there's an end game here that's in our benefit, that we get to define it, this role in terms of being self-determining. Nobody set goals for us that we have to do. This is us saying what we want and going for it. We're not like a one-off. We're a part of something called this EFOD movement, if you will. So that's equitable food-oriented development. So it's something that community groups like ours across the nation are doing. We just happen to be one of the organizations playing that out here. This is not like a risk. This is something, this is a movement. This is a current way of looking at how to achieve and get to that end goal. So we need help getting there. We have the role of being a catalyst, right? And maybe being a role model for other communities. But we're doing this. We've had challenges. You know, we wanted to go in and put a garden in a public space. We think it's a good idea, but people outside of the neighborhood would come and put their opinion in, like, that matters at this level. At this level, what matters most is that the people who are here say that we want to embrace this. And then we, as a catalyst organization, will serve a role in terms of making these resources available so that people can actually come out and do the things that we wish to do in this neighborhood, as opposed to other people coming in and telling us what we have to do as if we have to wait for that news. That's not necessary with this movement.
And Sona, what gives you hope and keeps you grounded?
Diane Moss gives me hope.
Me too.
You give me hope. You know, people that are fighting for a more just world give me hope. And like Diane shared, this is a movement. It's a strong movement, and it goes well beyond Southeastern San Diego, California. I mean, this is a national, global movement for justice. And that work is going to go on. That work's going to continue. And that gives me hope, because the future will look different because of the work that people that are fighting for justice are doing today, have done. I mean, we have to acknowledge that, right? You know, where we are in this current moment is clearly standing on the shoulders of so many activists like Fannie Lou Hamer, like others that have made our work and our being here possible. And we're also part of that movement. It's an arc. And we're all, I mean, you asked why engaging youth is so important. That's the future that's going to continue this fight for justice and transforming communities, transforming our world.
If you wanted listeners to take away one thing from this podcast, whether that be about food sovereignty, food apartheid, or the Good Food District and our mission within it, what should it be?
Okay, you asked for one thing. That's like a difficult thing. I'm just going to say that this is maybe one of many, is to... you have to take some kind of action. You can't passively wait on this one. Apartheid means you have to be
sovereignty?
Sovereignty means you have to actively be involved. You know, often here, there's a particular store that people say that they want in our neighborhood. I'm like, well, that store is not coming. So what is it that we like about that store that we can bring into our own neighborhoods? Let's dream, because in dreaming, I think there's some healing that comes with dreaming, because it's the possibilities of what are to come. And let's take that dream and use that as a starting point, because we've already dreamed. We now have a plan. We now have technical teams that are associated to help us do the work. But every step of this work, the people who live here have to be involved. So my one thing is, you have to be involved. If you're eating, you need to be involved in this neighborhood at making what you eat more accessible here. You don't have to get in your car and go somewhere.
Sona, what would you like to leave the listeners with?
I'm just going to build upon what Diane said, and maybe just add that the why you need to take action. So we're all connected, right? The health and well-being of one is intimately tied to the health and well-being of all. So whether or not you live in this community, whether or not you think that this community needs what it is that they're asking for, your health at the end of the day is tied to the health of all of the people and the community of Southeastern San Diego. So there's no way out. If we're in this together, and if we want a better world, then we have to take action.
We got to work for it. Mm-hmm. If we want it, we got to work for it.
And recognize that we all matter. We all matter, and we all play a role in building the dream, and right? Making the dream come alive.
And we deserve it, right? There has to be an understanding that we deserve access to healthy foods. We deserve the ability to have agency over how those foods are created and distributed. And so I just want to say thank you so much, Ms. Moss. Thank you so much, Sona. I know that I feel inspired, and I am very willing and ready to put in some of the work necessary. And as long as some of the listeners on here feel the same way I do, then maybe we just will get to food sovereignty. Maybe we will be able to show that the Good Food District is a destination. It's something for people to discover. And with that, we'll see you next time here on the Good Food Podcast.